When you look at this city of Cologne with its rich cultural heritage, you might think that there's hardly anything that Cologne has not seen, but today we turn our attention to a man who shaped Cologne like no other in medieval science, Albertus Magnus, as they say in Latin, or Albert in English, but I guess I will stick to Albertus, also known as Albert the Great. He was one of the most important personalities of the Middle Ages, an outstanding thinker of his time. And with that, dear people, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a kind of microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows, from the Romans up until our present time. Today we are immersing ourselves in a fascinating world of a man who had a strong influence on the city of Cologne on an intellectual and spiritual level, Albertus Magnus, Albert the Great. You may know him as the great thinker and scholar of the Middle Ages if you are from Cologne, but here at the beginning we take a closer look at a lesser known but all the more exciting episode in his life, his alleged role in the construction of today's Gothic Cologne Cathedral, a beautiful legend, right after the intro. So, what's the story behind Albertus Magnus and the cathedral building? Let's find out. The legend I'm about to tell you is not to be found in history books, but it's one of the more popular legends surrounding the great thinker and the construction of Cologne Cathedral. Among others, it was written down by the Cologne historian Leonard Enne in the 19th century. Those who studied history at university in Germany may know him as one of the contributors to the general German biography. It is still a great reference work today and is freely available online. However, due to its age, it is now more of a historical source itself than a reference work. Construction of Cologne Cathedral, one of the largest Gothic cathedrals in Europe, began in 1248. This construction was to take over 600 years, but the foundation stone was laid during the lifetime of Albertus Magnus, and legend has it that he played a not insignificant role in the planning of this gigantic project. And this is where our story's legend begins. Albertus, the great thinker and scholar, is said to have been sitting in his room one evening in 1248, deep in thought. He was working on the plans for Cologne Cathedral, as the building was not just a secular project, but was primarily intended to be a work in honor of God. But although Albertus was a man of great intellect, he despaired of the task. How was he to create a plan that would meet the expectations of the cathedral chapter and, above all, the demands of heaven? He prayed to the Blessed Virgin Mary, asking for enlightenment to help him complete this monumental work, and literally, as the legend goes, something incredible happened. He got his enlightenment. A bright light flashed before his eyes. You can imagine it like a flash of lightning that illuminates the entire room for a moment, but this time the light remained. It was not the light of the sun, but a mild, gentle glow that filled the entire room. Startled, Albertus looked up, and four men in white robes appeared before him, crowned with golden diadems that sparkled in the light. It was a truly heavenly apparition. Each of these men carried tools that indicated their abilities. The first, an old man with a long white beard, carried a compass. The second, a little younger, wielded a protractor. The third, a sturdy man with a curly beard, held a yardstick, and the fourth, a young man with blonde curls, carried a pair of scales. According to legend, these four men were the masters of holy architecture. They walked towards Albertus, and behind them, in heavenly beauty, the Virgin Mary herself appeared. In her hand, she held a lily stem adorned with bright flowers. It is said that the Virgin Mary instructed the four masters to draw up a plan for the new Cologne Cathedral. Albertus could only watch as the masters began to draw up the blueprints with great diligence. With incredible precision, they drew the lines and proportions of a majestic structure that surpassed anything Albertus had ever seen in its splendor and size. The lines glowed in the room as if they were made of pure starlight. It was a vision he had never experienced before. For a moment, the entire blueprint seemed to be finished in a bright beam, a miracle building that appeared to be the work of God himself, almost like a 3D printer model, only with light. But just as quickly as the apparition had appeared, it disappeared again. The four masters, the Holy Virgin, and the light dissolved, and Alberto sat alone again in his now dark room. But the image of the building plan stuck in his mind. The plan of the cathedral, as it had been shown in this vision, was so clear and detailed that Albertus was able to keep it in his memory, and he wrote it down. And the blueprint of today's Cologne Cathedral was created. Of course, after listening to this, I know what you're saying. It all sounds a little too good to be true, doesn't it? But let's remember, many great buildings and works of art of the time were often associated with such legends. The grandeur of Cologne Cathedral and the long construction period of this gigantic project give the legend a certain magic. Well, we don't know whether Albertus really designed such a plan. There's no concrete evidence that he was the architect behind the construction of the cathedral. Historians suspect that it was more likely the combination of his fame as a scholar and his proximity to Cologne that inspired this legend. However, the so-called Plan Riss F, the blueprint, which is now considered one of the most important documents in Gothic architecture in Germany, could have been inspired by such stories. This plan shows, indeed, in real, the ambitious dimensions and complex structures that made Cologne Cathedral one of the most impressive sacred buildings in the world up until today. This plan, which shows the mighty main facade of Cologne Cathedral to the west, was probably not drawn until sometime after Albertus died. I was once able to see the plan live in a special exhibition up close in the Cologne Cathedral treasury, and I will of course upload pictures of it to thehistoryofcologne.com. But let's start with his biography, with Albertus Magnus' biography. Albertus von Lauingen was born around the year 1200 in Lauingen, a small town in Swabia, but the part of Swabia that is nowadays part of the Free State of Bavaria. But if you ever go there, don't call the people there Bavarians. They will kill you, I promise. They are Swabians. Albertus, who was born into a wealthy family, his father was probably an imperial civil servant, was prepared for a career in the church at an early age. But even as a young man, it was clear that he was more interested in the big questions than in purely spiritual matters like praying all day long. As is so often the case in history, we do not really know much about his youth or his time as a young adult. Albertus began his studies in Padua in Italy, where he studied philosophy, for example. Certainly also the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle. In the Middle Ages, Aristotle was practically the star philosopher. What surprised me at first was that Aristotle was a pagan philosopher. Well, he never had the chance to become a Christian anyway, as he lived in the 4th century B.C., so before Christ. But that did not stop Albertus and his later pupil Thomas Aquinas from studying him in particular. Here they tried to harmonize Christian theology and Aristotelian reason. Albertus' incredible intellectual curiosity was already evident in Padua. He not only studied theology, but was also interested in the natural sciences, astronomy, logic, and mathematics. In 1223 or 1229, I really found various dates about that, he, Albertus, joined the Dominican order, and this was the beginning of his stellar career as one of the most influential scholars in the medieval world. Joining the Dominican order back then, at the beginning of the 13th century, was something completely rebellious. It's hard to imagine nowadays, I know, but the Dominican order was still young at the time. The new order arose from a reform movement within the church just a few years ago, from that time we're talking about, and they protested against a largely corrupt clergy in their eyes, who were all too interested in a worldly goods were to be brought back to the evangelical ideals of poverty, simplicity, and simple charity. Joining such an order was therefore truly radical in that time, one could almost say. We already know this from other religious orders founded in previous centuries. They all had the same goal of going back to the original times in their eyes, like the Cistercians or Premonstratensians did in the 12th century. After joining the Dominican order, Albertus traveled to Cologne. The Dominicans had only recently established their main branch in the German part of the empire here in Cologne in 1221. Albert was trained there as a Dominican monk and was ordained a priest. His path then took him to many places and initially away from Cologne. As a lector, a reader, in church services, his path led him to Hildesheim, Freiburg, Regensburg and Strasbourg, which at that time still belonged to the empire for many centuries to come. In 1243, Albertus arrived at the top address of knowledge and teaching in Christian Europe. He studied in Paris, obtained his doctorate there, and was given permission to teach himself. You can probably tell, an extremely long period of study that lasted over two decades. He started in the 1220s and now he's finished at the end of the 1240s. But let me say that it was to pay off. Albertus Magnus would go down in history as one of the greatest scholars of the Middle Ages, as comprehensively educated in every field that was known to the known world back then. He was henceforth regarded as a doctor universalis, an all-knowing doctor. In 1248, Albertus came to Cologne for the first time for an extended period and became one of the city's most important inhabitants. Albertus returned to Cologne in 1248 to teach at the newly founded Dominican school in Cologne. He established the first German Dominican general house of studies there. The later University of Cologne, which was to be founded in 1388 as the fourth university in the empire, emerged from the very school at which the Dominican order taught in Cologne. He remained here, with a brief period of 2 years and several journeys in between, until his death in 1280. Let's pause for a moment. Cologne in the 13th century. Imagine that, the largest city in the empire, full of sights, sounds and impressions. Merchants, craftsmen, priests and scholars like Albertus bustled between the impressive buildings and narrow alleyways in the center in the harbor district. People from all over the known world stopped off here. You could hear people discussing everything everywhere: politics, trade, theology. And Albertus, the Dominican monk with an alert mind, was right in the middle of it all, and you might have guessed it, I cannot pronounce theology. One of his most famous students, of Albertus Magnus, was none other than Thomas Aquinas, who would later become one of the most important philosophers and theologians of the Middle Ages as well. He had followed his mentor from Paris to Cologne, but other brilliant minds also came to learn from Albertus, who was soon given the nickname, as already mentioned, Doctor Universalis. And this title was by no means an exaggeration, as Albertus's knowledge covered almost all the science known at that time. Aristotle, the ancient philosopher, continued to be a central element of his research. In the 1250s, he devoted himself incessantly to examining and commenting on Aristotle's works. Thanks to new contacts with the Arab world, Aristotle's texts were once again available in Latin in Europe for the first time since late antiquity. In the meantime, they were simply lost. For contemporaries of the 13th century, these texts were virtually new, and naturally a curious mind like Albertus pounced on them, while others paid less attention, maybe, to the texts of a pagan philosopher, or sometimes even rejected them altogether. One aspect that set Albertus apart from many of his contemporaries was his deep curiosity for nature. While other theologians thought primarily about God and the afterlife, Albertus was fascinated by the world around him. He wanted to understand how nature worked, from plants to animals and celestial bodies. Many of his colleagues were of the opinion that the world could not be studied at all. Albertus, however, did. He wanted to understand God's creation through observation. And in doing so, he chose an empirical approach and later foundations on which today's natural sciences are based. In his writings on natural history, Albertus showed himself to be a true forerunner of modern science. He observed animals, plants, and stones with a scientific approach, and that was atypical for the time. While many of his contemporaries already said, believed that it was enough to read the works of ancient philosophers or the Bible, Albertus went out into the world and examined it himself. He was a true biologist. He also explored the world as a whole. Contrary to popular belief today, people knew that the world was a sphere, a globe, and not a disc. It was not for nothing that the rulers in the Middle Ages carried the orb in their hands as an insignia of power, as a sign of the world. Albertus also established this through his observations, but in the world, this was really nothing groundbreaking. Hardly anyone questioned this in the Middle Ages. The earth is round and not flat. Albertus's fascination with nature was also evident in his work on alchemy. Yes, you heard right. Albertus Magnus was also involved in alchemy, especially with minerals. Before you think that Albertus was just chasing crazy ideas, let me explain. Alchemy was a respected science in the Middle Ages that tried to fathom the secret of matter. Albertus was not looking for gold, as is often thought when it comes to this subject, but he was primarily interested in chemical processes and the composition of substances. It was the precursor to chemistry, so to speak, which only emerged a few centuries later. It was only afterwards that alchemy got the sometimes bad reputation as today, because we now have chemistry. Despite his attempts to understand the laws of nature, Albertus always firmly believed that science could never replace faith. For him, the two were inextricably linked. He saw science as a way to better understand God's creation and thus come closer to God himself. And yeah, for that, let's take a short break for a drink. Albertus was not only a scientist, he was also an influential politician. In 1260, he was appointed Bishop of Regensburg, although he only held this position for 2 years. In fact, Albertus had no desire for the office and had even objected to it. But the Pope remained firm and insisted, and as a faithful churchman, Albertus listened and did what he was asked to. When the Pope died the following year, Albertus traveled to Rome especially to persuade now the new Pope to remove him as a bishop again, and he was successful. After 2 years, he was free to go. That doesn't sound like a great politician, but we will soon have two major conflicts in the city in quick succession in which Albertus will mediate between the citizens of Cologne and the Archbishop in a decisive and face-saving manner. So I'm leaving a little bit this fact out that he was a great politician for another episode. But freed from the episcopal dignity, Albertus indeed returned to what he loved most, teaching and writing. He returned to Cologne in 1262 and dedicated the rest of his life to science and theology. Oh my god, I cannot pronounce that word. Albertus Magnus died in Cologne in 1280. He reached the age of at least 80, if not more. He left behind an impressive body of work comprising countless writings. His thoughts and theories influenced not only his immediate students, but the entire scholasticism, the intellectual movement of the Middle Ages. But Albertus was not just a theorist, he was someone who sought the connection between science and faith, as already mentioned, something revolutionary that was to pave the way for the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. In my opinion, however, Albertus has been somewhat forgotten outside of Cologne and away from medieval fans. Even his pupil Thomas Aquinas is now much better known than his master. What a pity, really. Perhaps a call to make him better known again? Justice for Albertus Magnus? But you know me, this is not meant to be a call for glorification. As usual for clergymen of the Middle Ages and later times, he was ambivalent towards Judaism, the large minority in Christian Europe. Jewish scholars and philosophers, as well as Jewish figures from the Bible, were of course diligently treated and received in his works. However, when the University of Paris condemned the Talmud, one of the central texts of Judaism, as heresy, Albertus signed this condemnation. And the result, in the following days around Paris, numerous places where copies of the Talmud stolen from Jews were burnt. Today, there are many reminders of Albertus Magnus in Cologne. In 1956, a statue was erected in front of the main building at the University of Cologne, showing him in the thinker's pose, looking curiously into the distance, his head resting on his hand and his arm propped up on his knee. He watches over all those who populate his university, which was refounded in 1919. Albertus Magnus was buried in his own monastery, his Dominican monastery in Cologne, not far from Cologne Cathedral. But when the monastery was dissolved in 1804, he was reburied in the neighboring church of St. Andrew, a church we have spoken a lot already in this podcast. Also, this church is diagonally opposite of Cologne Cathedral, which legend has it that he designed, although we do know that this is not true. During opening hours, though, you can visit the great medieval scholar in the crypt. If you do so, say hi for me. Here too, it is interesting to note how his veneration within the Catholic Church gained momentum in later centuries. He was beatified in 1622, a time of confessional division and the Catholic Counter-Reformation in the midst of the bloody 30 Years' War. However, it took another 300 years before the Pope canonized Albertus in 1931, so almost just 100 years ago. What do I find so interesting as a modern historian? I have long been a firm believer that the Middle Ages were not a dark time in which only misery prevailed. What our ancestors experienced, for example, in the Second World War, or what people are currently experiencing in the current wars and conflicts on this planet, can hardly be compared to the Middle Ages in terms of scale and intensity of cruelty and malice. And yet, it surprised me how someone like Albertus, with a fixed, closed, and undisturbed religiously Christian worldview, always managed to think outside the box, despite all the circumstances of his time. And let's be honest, do we always dare to do that? Think outside of the box? And no, I don't mean that in any kind of fanciful or conspiratorial way. Don't worry. For Albertus, it was perfectly possible to reconcile the old with the new to a certain extent. He recognized that man can learn through faith as well as through reason, an important step for the intellectual development of Europe. Well, this was the story of Albertus Magnus, a man who was not only an outstanding scientist and theologian, but also a true Cologne native. Because did you notice something? We haven't even covered that yet. His work in Cologne. We'll shed some light on that elsewhere, but for that episode, I wanted you to get to know Albertus Magnus as a whole. So, let's not really say goodbye to Albertus Magnus yet. We will encounter him again in a conflict between the city and the archbishop, perhaps even several times, but he's so important for Cologne's history that I thought I have to give him a general own episode. And when we talk about the conflicts inside the city between the archbishop and the citizenry, it would not be the right place to point out Albertus Magnus' biography there somewhere in between. The literature I used this time was by Hugo Stehkämper with the simple title Albertus Magnus. and then by Ingrid Krämer-Rügenberg from the series of Great Thinkers, also with the simple title Albertus Magnus. Thanks this time to Antje, Christian, Jana, Silvia and Carolina for your tips via PayPal, and many thanks to my Patreons for your continued financial support. Next time, we'll take another look at the construction site of Cologne Cathedral. How did people actually build on a medieval construction site? I hope I'm just as interested in that as you are. So please recommend me further this podcast, and see you soon. Auf Wiedersehen.